From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on Forum this morning, Mark Leibovich's new book, This Town, opens at the funeral of NBC's Tim Russert, the newsman whom Leibovich calls the mayor of Washington, D.C.'s political class. Amid genuine mourning and sadness for Russert, the memorial soon devolves into the ultimate networking event for the Capitol's entrenched and powerful cabal of lobbyists, socialites, and pundits. Leibovich joins us in studio to discuss the controversial book, which offers a rare and colorful glimpse into the Beltway's permanent political class. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. This Town is the title of Mark Leibovich's recent book. It's all about Washington, D.C., a town that many feel is not like any other town. And he gives us a sobering, though often amusing, view of our political elite, which might make even the more cynical among us wince and recoil. A veteran political reporter, a national political correspondent who is the D.C.-based chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. Mark Leibovich also spent 9 years with the Washington Post, and he was here working for the San Jose Mercury News back in the day. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and glad to have you here.
Good to be here, Michael.
Welcome. Well, you're going to be able to eat in this town, have lunch in this town again after this book?
So far, so good. It's been a couple months, and there have been no threats of physical violence. And it's been fine. I mean, I think the book has probably made some people uncomfortable, but I think that discomfort is a good thing in the Washington media, especially. So it's been pretty mild.
But you're a political reporter. You need friends. You need colleagues. You need associates. You need cronies, don't you?
I guess so. No, I haven't lost any friends. I mean, my goal here was not to lose any real friends, and Washington is a pretty friendship has a pretty cheap connotation in Washington, as it does like on Facebook or something.
They say if you want a friend, get a dog.
Or go on to Facebook or something. No, yeah. But it's been okay.
Well, you begin with Tim Russert's funeral, the man who presided over Meet the Press and who was much beloved and who was even known, or is known in your book, as the mayor of
official
the political
Washington,
class,
yes.
Official Washington. And there's a kind of metaphor that stands out in your recounting of Russert's funeral. It's sort of like, well, what can this one do for me and what can that one do for me, whether it's a media person or somebody looking for political points?
Right. No, I was struck by that scene, and that was the moment where I really wanted to jump off from. It was June of 2008. It was this huge extravaganza, state funeral-like event at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. And it was the dawn of the Obama era. The general election campaign was about to begin. The economy was about to crash. And you had this giant of a newsman just struck down in the prime of life. And I was struck by how the spectacle of it became this cocktail party. Just you had people trying to throw business cards into the hands of John McCain and Barack Obama and the Clintons. And you had all the tribes represented, the Democrats, the Republicans, the media, the lobbyists. And I was just struck by how this pageant, this carnival, just was playing out in broad daylight on national television. And people obviously focused on the speeches. But I thought that this was a moment that I wanted to capture. I then went back and sort of deconstructed it. I debriefed a lot of people. And I thought that this was sort of a nice place to really chart a 5-year period in the life of the nation's capital and really profile, again, the carnival that's broken out here at a time when the rest of the country has really felt terribly about the place.
Yeah, well, what I was struck by in that carnivalesque atmosphere that you write about, and you've got people essentially playing up to Robert Gibbs and David Axelrod, you know, thinking maybe I'll get a position in this new administration if Joe Scarborough and Nina Brzezinski appear, and people want to, you know, be on Morning Joe, and they're playing up to them and so forth. This is a funeral. I mean, you know, it's something that's supposed to be stately and interning someone who was much beloved, but there's no shame there. Really.
There is no shame. And again, I mean, there has been a lack of shame and certainly a lack of self-awareness in D.C. for many, many decades. This is not a new phenomenon. But what has been striking, I think, about the last few years has been the infusion of so much money into Washington, into the political system. Washington is now by far the wealthiest metropolitan area in the country. It's home to 7 of the 10 wealthiest counties in the United States, again, at a time when the rest of the country is just tanked. I think new media has added many layers of vanity to this sort of easy fame and easy second act game, to where you have this
anarchy. I thought Fitzgerald said there are no second acts.
There are many second acts. I mean, there is this – it's sort of this anarchy in the peanut gallery. And I mean, I think one of the things that has struck a chord with this book is that the media is very much, I guess, a target. I mean, I do take some of my colleagues to task for being probably too embroiled into this culture they're supposed to be covering objectively. And look, Washington, as I say puts the me in media, and they are part of this class.
It's also a revolving door now. I mean, the disproportionate number, or the quantum leap from those who are in government service who have gone into lobbying, you know, has just continued to move up. And it's a money culture. And you say it thrives on gridlock. It's based on disagreement and status quo.
It's true. I mean, I think one thing people miss about Washington, especially from the outside, is that they assume that Washington is just hopelessly divided, because that is the narrative that they hear. In fact, Washington is just hopelessly interconnected. I mean, a lot of the people you see yelling at each other on cable television are, in fact, you know, scheming in green rooms and going into business together. I mean, we're living in a time when 50% of all retiring or voted out senators go on to become lobbyists. That compares to 3% in 1974. And look, if an immigration bill passes tomorrow, if a tax reform bill passes tomorrow, that is tens of billions of dollars in unrealized lobbying fees and consulting fees and shouting matches on cable. So in a sense, the city does very, very well amidst this dysfunction.
Our guest, by the way, is Mark Leibovich, chief national correspondent for New York Times Magazine and author of This Town. Let me give the whole title, Two Parties and a Funeral Plus, Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. And he will be actually appearing at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco tonight at 6 o'clock p.m. The picture you give here really is also, he used the word swarm, of an insider culture and a club and a sense that really what most of the people who are there are about is not necessarily public service or serving the people, right, or their constituency. It's about promoting themselves.
It is. And I think, again, I mean, this is not an entirely new phenomenon. I mean, there have been hustlers and opportunists in Washington from the days of the founders. But I think, again, I mean, the insider club of Washington used to be a fairly small group of dinner party attendees and administration officials. Now you have, you know, again, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people partaking by tweet or Facebook. Everyone gets a platform. And again, it has sort of taken the central ethic of Washington, which is public service, supposedly, and turned it into self-service. And again, this is a city now where people come to get rich. This wasn't true even 20 years ago.
But this is not only not true. I mean, what you're saying is not only axiomatic about politicians. It's also the media that comes under your indictment here. Punditry, you say, has replaced reportage. And the fact of the matter is that even all the media people are there to self-brand, to get the exclusive, to get the story, and to further themselves.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, punditry is the new goal standard of our industry. I mean, it's where people get paid. I mean, it's where, I mean, the fact that a cable host, you know, can walk through an airport and get, you know, $20,000 to speak anywhere around the country they want is, I think it's telling. And I also think it's telling that it's happened at a time when I think the biggest stories of the day have not been broken by inside sort of on the bus reporters. I mean, it's been you have an age where, again, I mean, the media has become part of the spectacle. And I think, again, the public interest has not been necessarily served.
All this, and it even gets into narcissism and pomposity and hypocrisy. Carnival is a good word. I'm also thinking of, you know, just a spectacle of many rogues and totally self-centered and self-seeking people. Is this something we didn't know about Washington?
I think what we didn't know was the degree to which it has grown, it has changed, and that it has thrived at a time when the city has absolutely failed the American people. And that sounds, I mean, oddly, sounds like I'm giving a speech. You know, every time you say the American people, it feels like you're preaching. But I think that people have a very, very shallow notion of what has gone on in the nation's capital. It's a fairly shallow disdain. I wanted to flesh it out more. And look, I did it as an insider. I mean, that's the role I play, or that's the perspective I have, and I didn't really have a choice. So, yeah, I mean, I think that that's part of the reason maybe the book's gotten a lot of attention. But I, again, like, I welcome the conversation, and hopefully it'll continue.
Is it so polarized and so narcissistic and so self-driven and maybe even avaricious in terms of money-seeking that it's beyond salvation?
I hope not. I actually don't think it's sustainable. I mean, I think one of the things that has been gratifying about this book has been the reaction from outside of the city, from both sides of the political spectrum. I mean, it's been one that's been it has stoked far more outrage outside of Washington than titillation. I mean, inside of Washington, people say, all right, what are the nuggets? Who wins? Who loses?
A lot of them just go to the index to see if they're in there.
Yes, and there's no index, so I unfortunately have to disappoint them. But no, I think outside, it's actually been a very, very fascinating discussion that's broken out. And I think a lot of it is fixated on the money, which is great because I think money is very much at the root of this. And then everyone always asks me, okay, Mark, what's your prescription? And then I put on my journalist hat where I say, I'm just holding a mirror to the culture. I don't do prescriptions. But look, I hope someone figures it out. I think this is not sustainable. And I think, frankly, it's an outrage.
Keep hearing, though, about, well, there are different kinds of public servants. There are those who really have altruism or good hearts or whatever, who really feel that the ideals of this country. And then we hear the other side of this. I actually had two freshman congressmen on, Eric Swalwell and Jared Huffman. Mm-hmm. And I kept thinking about the candidate. You know, these are both kind of idealistic guys when they went as a Mr. Smith goes to Washington type of thing. And then you become corrupted in Washington, or can you keep yourself immune from that?
I will say that there are people who do. I mean, there are many people there who are there for the right reasons and who do, I think, very, very good and important work. But I do think that I did look at the Obama arrival, this hopeful change brigade from 2008 as a case study in what these hopeful idealists go through when they try to change the whole machine. And there's a scene towards the end of the book where President Obama is like, in August of 2011, he convened Saturday meetings in the Roosevelt Room with his team, both from Chicago, his then fledgling reelection campaign, and his White House team. And they were talking strategy, and they were trying to integrate the campaign with what the White House was doing. And at the beginning, the president said, look, folks, I want to sort of try to get back to 2008 and try to have more open and candid discussions, and I want to trust you. I don't want things to leak. And after about the fourth or fifth meeting, he was feeling very good about the meetings. He wrote on a yellow legal pad things he was feeling he hadn't paid enough attention to in his first term. They included climate change, Guantanamo, gay marriage. I mean, a bunch of things that immigration was one. And sure enough, that leaked. And, you know, Jim Messina, his campaign manager in Chicago, heard about this, told the president. President came into the next Saturday's meeting. Everyone knew that he knew. We're sort of dreading it. And he said, folks, these have been great meetings. These have been some of the best meetings that we've had since we've been president. I want them to continue in some form. And if they do, it will be without me. And he gets up and he walks out. And Vice President Biden, who was also in the meetings, sort of chews everyone out and said, you guys let him down. Then Biden leaves. And then there's this sort of soul-searching meeting and in which Robert Gibbs finally, who was, I think, the most vociferous in this meeting, said, guys, what happened to us? Did we change Washington or did Washington change us? And that question does run through pretty much the whole narrative.
Well, you're tough on Obama. Of course, the timing of this book sort of came in concert with the Obama administration. But there are those who say, for example, in the media, I've heard them say on this program, they've felt that this administration is even more controlling and less transparent than the Bush administration.
They have transparency I would not give them a great grade on. I mean, I think part of it is they held themselves to a much higher standard. They promised so much more. They were not going to be they were not going to be what had come before. But look, I mean, I think they did their best to a point. I think that what people might have missed in 2008 is that they're politicians, and politicians are marketers, and they were trying to sell a message, and it was a very compelling message. And I don't doubt that many of them believed it. But I think if you looked at the people around Barack Obama then as now, I mean, these are people who have been in politics their entire lives. Many of them have been in Washington their entire lives and are still there. And many of them have sort of gone back into the private sector and have done very, very well with the rest of the sector.
Talking to Mark Leibovich, and he's chief national correspondent of the New York Times Magazine, author of This Town. Early on in your book, you quote Henry Allen of the Washington Post, and he made the statement about Washington being a place where fantasy and authenticity are close companions. One could say the same about Hollywood or Wall Street, and also there's a lot of connection between those three places. Although you single out Washington as a place unto itself, a state of belonging, a status, a commodity. Use all those signifiers.
Well, I mean, the big difference between – I mean, yes, it is a gold rush culture as it is Silicon Valley even. I mean, you know, Hollywood, Washington. The difference is Washington was supposed to be different. Again, this was supposed to be the city devoted to public service. And again, if you can be an insider, if you can be perceived as someone who – quote unquote, understands how Washington works, whether it's by a hall of mirrors or whether you actually have been in the trenches of how Washington works, it is an incredibly marketable commodity. You can
– Or even if you can give a heads up, you say.
Heads up. It's all you need to know. I mean, quite often all a lobbyist does is, you know, he'll read something in Politico or some sort of insider tip sheet and will call his client and say, hey, this is going to happen today, and they'll feel like they're in the know too. So the insiderness has flowered into a broader scope, and the guy gets paid and he feels marketable.
Well, but you know, what comes across in your book is also not only the money side of it, but the seeking of glory, really, and recognition. Mm-hmm. I mean, wanting to essentially be in that inside group, to have one's name in the newspaper, to be recognized, to not only get recognition, but to get something perhaps even more than that, a kind of self-validation.
Absolutely. Well, this is a story, and politics is very much a story of psychology at root. I mean, I think all the places we just mentioned, whether it's New York or Hollywood or even Las Vegas, I mean, these are theaters for reinvention. And Washington is one of the more compelling theaters for reinvention. I mean, people come from all over the country to try to change things and I think in some ways change themselves. And I think, again, if insiderness and another word, I guess, for power is insiderness, is the currency there, you are going to do anything you can to reach validation or achieve validation this way. And again, money is tied up in that, but I think money is a bigger part of it than it was before.
Well, I'm going to open our phone lines now. I know there are many of you who have your thoughts about Washington, how that town really is different and really what it means in terms of what it's supposed to mean, public service versus perhaps what has come to be seen as more the underside and what one can be very, in fact, cynical about in Washington, the charge after money and the charge after self-branding and all that sort of thing. We invite you to join the conversation. You can do that now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your involvement in the program, so feel free to join us toll-free, 866-733-6786, with Mark Leibovich. You can also chime in here by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org. And again, Mark Leibovich's book, This Town, opens at the funeral of NBC's Tim Russert, the man who was known as the mayor of the elite Washington, D.C. political class. And amid that mourning and sadness, the memorial soon devolves into the ultimate networking event for the Capitol's entrenched and powerful cabal of lobbyists, socialites, and pundits. Mark Leibovich talking about his controversial book with us, which really offers a rare and colorful glimpse into the Beltway's permanent political class. And it is a permanent class.
It very much is. I mean, the term that I use, and it's actually I stole it from Tom Coburn, who's a very conservative senator from Oklahoma, is that Washington has devolved into a permanent feudal class of insiders. And again, everyone's – I mean, the
fact – Except who are the serfs if it's
– The serfs
– Nobody wants to be a serf
it's, Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I think the serfs, if you sort of look – I mean, not everyone is making big money. I mean, there are a lot of lower-level Hill staffers and certainly reporters that I know who are not getting rich. But I think, again, I mean, it's a pole that people are trying to climb. But no, I mean, again, I think the biggest divide in Washington is not so much – Democrats and Republicans, it is insiders and outsiders. And the outsiders are getting more and more pushed, you know, physically and geographically outside the city limits. But also the perception of being someone on the inside has become – I mean, it leads people to fake it in some ways. And just to be part of that class is a huge commodity.
Well, you profile a number of these insiders. And I wondered media people like Andrea Mitchell and David Gregory, politicians like Dick Ebhardt, Richard Holbrooke, more on the foreign affairs side. Steve Schmidt, of course, was running the McCain campaign. But how to decide, really, who to profile?
It was somewhat by happenstance. I mean, I think I sort of would go, I mean, a lot of them were people who I thought I could make a larger point with. I mean, Steve Schmidt is a great example. I mean, he ran the McCain campaign. He was responsible for picking Sarah Palin, basically. And then he very ostentatiously spent the next year criticizing Sarah Palin, criticizing the campaign, being a source for Game Change, the book on the campaign and the eventual movie on the campaign. He was celebrated. His business did really, really well. And Steve, his brand, which is a word that
still advising Republicans.
Oh, very, very much
especially
so.
Especially on immigration issue, for example.
Absolutely. Season, yeah. No, he's a very – I mean, he's got a TV gig on MSNBC. His consulting firm is doing great. Woody Harrelson played him in the Game Change movie. He walked the red carpet at the opening. Look, I mean, Steve is a good guy, but I think he's a classic – example of the failing upward segment of Washington, where you will always eat lunch in this town again, which was one of the working titles of the book.
Chris, what does it do to the media people? You know, it's long been a criticism of many media watchers and those critical of the media of the chumminess, of croniness between media people and politicians. I mean, they need to feed each other. It's symbiotic, really, in many ways. They'll play tennis together. They'll have family outings together and all that sort of thing. What does this do for so-called more clinical or even if it exists, objective journalism?
Well, I mean, I think, look, I know a lot of these people. A lot of them are very, very good journalists. But you do wonder where is the line between friendship, personal life. I mean, the reason I focused on Andrea Mitchell is she's married to Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve. And their personal life, their social life, their professional life certainly overlaps so seamlessly. I mean, their wedding was officiated by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Colin Powell was in the wedding part. I mean, I remember reading an account of it, and it was like, wow, I mean, who's playing for what team? And you sort of got this – it was the kind of scene where if I were invited to the wedding and if I were in a mischievous mood, I might have written that.
Well, you were mischievous when you wrote about I love the story about Andrea Mitchell being introduced to Queen Elizabeth by George W. Bush.
Yes, now George Herbert Walker Bush. Yes, no.
H.W. Bush.
Well, yeah. No, Alan Greenspan used to date Barbara Walters, and then he broke up with Barbara Walters and started dating Andrea Mitchell. And Alan Greenspan took Andrea to a state dinner for Queen Elizabeth, and the first President Bush said, Your Majesty, this is Alan Greenspan and one of the most amazing television hosts in America, Barbara Walters. And he was appalled. And, of course, President Bush had to send a note of apology.
But these do. I mean, we're talking about an incestuous world.
We do. And I also – look, I think it's important to know that the biggest stories in Washington are almost always broken by outsiders. I mean, Woodward and Bernstein were not insiders in the early 70s. I mean, they were fairly anonymous Metro reporters. And I mean, we all know the story of the shoe leather that they expended to get the Watergate story. If you look at the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, yes, there are a lot of recognizable brands on TV, but I mean, the big stories were broken by outsiders. I mean,
but they got the story from an insider, Deep Throat. I mean, to a great extent,
that is true.
That started it off. So you need those sources. Even if you're an outsider.
You do, although Deep Throat was an insider, but he had a remove. And I think Edward Snowden is another sort of example now in Glenn Greenwald. I mean, certainly a lot of symbiosis between outsiders and journalists.
Talking all about this town, Washington, Mark Leibovich with us here in studio, Chief National Correspondent for New York Times Magazine. We'll hear from you when we return. Again, you can join us a number of ways. Go to our Facebook page, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, or email us, kqed.org. And you can call us, 866-733-6786. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Mark Leibovich, and his new book is called This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. He dishes on Washington, D.C.'s political class. I guess dish is the right verb, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is, although I hate the word dish. It's so I don't know. So I guess it implies gossip, which, of course, if people want to think it's gossip, it's fine. But as journalists, we shy away from that term.
There's some gossip in here. You got to have gossip nowadays. But really, it's an indictment in many respects. It's a calling to account. what Washington perhaps by implication and inference ought to be as opposed to what it is.
I like to think so. I mean, look, the book does have a very serious point, and one of the frustrating things about it has been how utterly trivially so many people inside of Washington have read it. I mean, they have read it as who wins, who loses, what are the nuggets, like what are the takeaways, like who comes off looking best and worst. And when you read the whole of it and you sort of see the larger message, I mean, much of it is centered on, you know, again, this sort of self-service versus public service evolution. You do see the serious point, but I think this is a classic example of Washington's inability to sort of absorb its own sort of self-reflection and sort of look seriously at a mirror of itself. Now, I've gotten a few emails from people in the book that I expected to be very angry emails that were quite humble, actually, which were, you know, this has really let me to think about this. And I won't name them because they're private, but they've been really quite gratifying. And I think most of the private response has been terrific. Some of the public response has been a bit hysterical, but that's sort of how Washington operates.
Well, let me give you some public responses. Some emails here. A listener writes, can your guest talk in a larger sense about the cultural shift that this represents, and what does that mean for us as a governed society?
I think it's quite sobering as a governing society. I mean, I think, you know, when you have so many people who are elected to public office who go on to become to whether it's lobbying or consulting, to work very, very closely with the people that they are doing business with as public servants, you wonder who are they working for when they are in office. There's a passage in here. I mean, I quote from Jack Abramoff's book. Now, Jack Abramoff is the picture of modern disgrace in Washington. He actually wrote a memoir in prison,
there's a movie based on it.
There's a movie based on it. Kevin Spacey played him. But it was. It was a very candid memoir in which he writes about how he would get to know these members of Congress, these staffers, people in the White House, and he would say to them at a certain point, you know, you're really good at this. When you're done working for Congressman X, or when you're done serve sort of with quotation marks, you should come think about work. You should think about coming to work for us. And they would say, yeah, maybe I will. And he said, I knew at that moment that we owned him, because at that moment, they knew that there's probably a seven-figure salary on the table waiting for them if they work to maintain this friendship.
It's interesting you should mention Abramoff, because there's also this characteristic, almost archetypical pattern of many politicians and many who live and breathe that political world who find themselves in disgrace and have the shame heaped upon them, and then suddenly it's all about redemption or trying to find redemption. It is in his case. It was in John Edwards' case. I mean, one can go on and on.
Right. No, I mean, look, there is always a second act. I mean, I don't have any doubt that Anthony Weiner...
I don't think there's a second act for him.
Well, no, of course there is. He will get a great cable show. He will get a book deal. He will get speaking fees. I guarantee you. I don't know.
Second act politically, though. No, I think he's dead in the water. Really,
he was ahead for a while, but yes, I think people were ready to give him a second. No, I mean, I think electorally, I would maybe put it in a different category. But look, I mean, memories are very, very short. I mean, part of this is a product of the media in this world and in this day and age.
Spitzer had a job as an anchor, right?
Spitzer had a job as an anchor. He'll probably have a job as a public, you know, official again soon. But no, I mean, there's chapter 8 in the book, which is sort of an object lesson of a disgraced congressional aide whose name is Kurt Bardella, who worked for Darrell Issa. And I'm sort of part of that story because Kurt was a source and he was a subject, and he was sending me a lot of emails from members of Congress and other reporters. And Politico learned about this, and it became a huge story, and Kurt was fired. And it was probably the subject of about 150 stories, literally, inside the Beltway in a week where I think Egypt was falling. I think the government was going to be shut down. But no, Kurt got his old job back with Darrell Issa 3 months later. He just went into business for himself. I'm sure he'll do fine.
Let me bring some callers on here. We go first to John. Good morning. You're on.
Yes, I've got a question about the nature of the intractable problems that we have in this country. I mean, Wall Street, financial crisis, the political divide, and, abuses by industry in one thing or another. How much of this really belongs at the doorstep of the lobbyists and those people, those insiders?
I think it's a big part of the problem. And I think people generally look at lobbyists as in an abstract way. It's like, okay, lobbyists bad. But the truth is the interest that can hire lobbyists, and we're talking tens of millions of dollars, billions of dollars spent on them a year, are the big corporate interests, the people who are averse to really any kind of major change. And the kinds of reform that I think a lot of people in the country are looking for are absolutely anathema to the interests of a lot of the people who can afford lobbyists. I mean, look, if you are a city council, if you're a community member and you don't want a parking garage to go up, you're not going to hire a lobbyist. But the company that is building the parking garage will probably hire a lobbyist. They'll probably go to the congressman, and that will be give you that much more of an advantage. So I think it's very, very it starts very, very small, but I think that in a big sense, it is a joining of very, very big and powerful interests.
It has so many implications. We had a guest on yesterday who's written a book about the restaurant industry and about the second NRA, the National Restaurant Association, which has made it virtually impossible to move forward on $2.13 an hour as a minimum wage for restaurant workers, excluding tips. David writes, I think Lawrence Lessig has focused on money being the root cause of all that is wrong in Washington. Does Mark support Lessig's efforts to fix it, money bomb, or other ways to fix it?
Okay, this is, again, the part of the conversation
where I stopped.
You're not giving
the prescriptions.
I'm not giving the prescriptions, but Lawrence Lessig is, I think, a hero in this. I mean, he's one of the more thoughtful people here. I mean, I've talked to him. I'm hoping that I will talk to him more. I mean, I think he identified the problem. I think he's spoken more eloquently about it than most, and I hope more people do.
And you can listen to the interview that we did with Lawrence Lessig. Well, there are a couple of them on in our archives. Mark from Berkeley writes, feels like Washington has become a money monster that corrupts everything it touches, all the while convincing its children that they are doing good by doing well, when both the powerful and those entrusted to report on them are all on the hunt for the multi-million dollar payday. Who can we believe in?
It's a great question. I mean, I think it's not that across the board black and white. I think there are many, many, you know, good journalists and good, you know, sort of good public servants in D.C. and anywhere. But look, I think that email is emblematic of a cynicism that is both, you know, rampant but also justified.
And a tweet from Ashley who says, I'd love to hear your guest's take on how Washington is portrayed in the Netflix series House of Cards.
It's funny. I mean, Kevin Spacey, who's the star of House of Cards, came to the White House Correspondents' Dinner last year, and he was just mobbed for autographs. And, I mean, it was here's this figure who, you know, plays this, I mean, just an absolutely hideous congressman. I mean, very corrupt, very effective. And, I mean, he does not exactly paint the city in a positive light, and yet he is being swarmed. I mean, celebrity is all. Now, as a side note, I interviewed the cast of House of Cards last week as part of a Times Talk, which is a weekly series or a regular series we do at the Times, and it was on the set of the next series of House of Cards or the next season in Baltimore. And Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright, who is his co-star on the show, said that, look, I mean, this is one of the things that people like about this series is that it shows a Washington where things get done. I mean, they actually pass a big education bill, and I think they think it's entertaining. I think it's extremely well acted and extremely well told. But they also think that there is a sort of perverse fantasy being lived out on screen about things actually moving forward in some way, which I think had some merit.
What about Sorkin stuff? I mean, the new one, The Newsroom, and the one before about the White House?
Yeah, I haven't seen The Newsroom that much. I know it's gotten a lot of attention. I mean, West Wing is actually, I think, it's sort of a cultural benchmark in Washington because I think there are a lot of people who grew up and who are working in Washington now idolizing President Bartlett or idolizing Josh Lynam or Lyman and Toby or whoever. I mean, they don't know. They were brought to Washington in some ways by the cinematographic sexiness of that whole game and just the sort of the high stakes chess match. And again, it sort of elevated the operative to a celebrity level that before was sort of restricted to the principals. I mean, you see now, I mean, many people on Capitol Hill who were here because or go to Washington not because they loved Ronald Reagan or John F. Kennedy or Barack Obama or whoever, but because it was so exhilarating by what they saw on TV.
And the White House Correspondents' Dinner, that's a very important event in terms of these insiders and the kind of flocking around the honey and all that that we've been talking about.
Yeah, no, the White House Correspondents' Dinner used to be this fairly sleepy spring banquet in which politicians and journalists would convene at the Washington Hilton, and a couple speeches were given. It has since metastasized into a five-day, you know, festival of pre-parties and post-parties, and because a single banquet is no longer sufficient to celebrate the accomplishments of the Washington media. But, I mean, tens of millions of dollars are spent on entertainment and food, and it's just this – it's this perverse and grotesque kind of collision of the bubble worlds, whether it's Hollywood or Washington. And it's a great metaphor for Washington's inability to really look at itself, change itself, and to know that something is completely out of control and yet keep doing it because it's fun.
We go to more of your calls. Kevin, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hey, Michael, and guests, welcome. I just want to say it's like my number one problem. You know, most of us in the world have to get up every morning, go to work, come home, you know, make some dinner, get a workout, and go to bed. We don't have time to deal with this. You take polls and you find out 10% of the American people think Congress is doing a good job. So I'm putting it on the press and you two gentlemen, right? You write a book and you kind of call this out, but at the same time you say this guy Steve from Game Changers is a good guy. You got to stop that. If the guy screwed the country once, you know, he screwed the country. And Michael, when you have guests on there, Willie Brown or whatnot, and they run the city into the ground and they hire buffoons and they promote people who are incompetent, you know, you got to stay on them. I mean, because you're the only voice we have that's going to call these people on the carpet. I don't have time to call every day. You know, I'm changing the baby's diaper right now. You know, and my point is this. You know, they're going to survive, but democracy is not surviving. You know, will not, and it is not. You know, real people suffer. When you look at the numbers of people that are poor and actually ignorant in this country and in jail and whatnot, it's disgusting, disturbing. You see it when you walk down the street in this city and probably much more so in other cities. You guys are the only voice we have, the only people we have that can call these people out on the carpet and stay on them. When you ask a question and they try to dodge, you got to stay on them. And you know what? If you ask Willie Brown a question, he doesn't want to answer it, kick him off the air. Have a backup guest ready to go at all times. Play the damn symphony. But you guys are the voice. We need you to stay on these people and get answers and bring up the facts.
I thank you for your call, Kevin, and I understand your concerns. I think Mark probably does, too. In fact, I'm looking at an email here from a listener named Brian. It says, how should a media outlet like Forum do right by the people to counter the media complicity in this new paradigm?
Look, I mean, it's something we all struggle with in Washington. I mean, look, I mean, I work for a major news organization, the New York Times, and we all struggle, especially when we're in Washington, with what is the appropriate distance. I mean, the New York Times stopped going to the White House Correspondents' Dinner in 2007, and my boss at the time, Dean Baquet, who was the Washington bureau chief then, now the managing editor of the paper, he just decided that it was too cozy. It really had outlived its usefulness, and he didn't want to be a part of it. I think that was a great decision. I don't think any of us miss it. But no, look, I mean, I didn't have the luxury to write this book as a foreign correspondent in which I could swoop in, you know, claim I was an outsider, burn down the village, leave. I mean, I'm a working journalist. I'm attached to a major newspaper, and I'm obviously mindful of how this world works. Now,
I'll tell you something else, though, that needs to be appended here, and that is what we alluded to before. I mean, first of all, I think you and I believe in civility, and you don't necessarily, you know, become an attack dog when you have a politician there. But if you become too aggressive, politician's not going to talk to you. It's not going to come back on the program. I mean,
right.
So there's a red lines.
There's a red line. No, I mean, look, it's thoughtfulness. I mean, I have a real bias towards politicians who are authentic, who will actually tell you what they think. I mean, I do think that they're – if I were to put my quasi-political consultant hat on, I don't have one, but if I were to pretend –
Jockeying for a job here?
No, I'm not, believe me. No, it's not one part of the revolving door I'm going to walk through. But I do think that there is an incredible market for a politician who will just be completely unplugged. I mean, John McCain in 2000 had an incredible following, certainly in the media. But I think, you know, he really did capture the imagination of a segment of the people who were just so hungry for a kind of language, if nothing else, of straight talk that is not common in the political world. And people say, well, that's impossible now because you'd have Twitter and people would be tweeting out the latest thing and no one would pay attention. I would just love to see someone try. And I think that there is such a great hunger for change and authenticity in the political marketplace that I think it could take off. And I think Barack Obama actually benefited from that to some degree.
Scott, one of our listeners, writes, the Syria conflict is the latest example of a complicated, important story that D.C. journalists choose to boil down to a political sporting event that the president or Republicans are either winning or losing. Do you think this trend of political obsession is new, or is it something that was always there and the cable news channels and internet simply give a broader platform to?
I think it's what's new is, again, the broader platform, but also the shorter attention spans and the need to have people write the stories and get sort of the who wins, who loses narrative out in real time, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's, you know, in one of the 20 blog posts a reporter now has to do in a given day instead of really reflecting and talking to people. But no, I mean, political news and very much Washington journalism is very reductive, and it goes down to the horse race. And I think the horse race is just going that much faster now, given the new media tools.
Another listener writes, I tend to agree with the author somewhat. I feel that the key word with the Obama administration is Chicago politics. Having been born and raised in Chicago, I see the corrupt and insider tactics. Or it's just Chicago politics calling the shots. Obama was installed in office by the Chicago-Illinois machine. Just take a look who the president is surrounded and advised by. Sad but true. Now, I've said that I think sometimes Chicago politics is a code that one hears to suggest that maybe there's some mafiosi-type Capone tendencies in this administration, or, you know, it evokes dead people voting and Blagojevich and all sorts of things. But right. Nevertheless, there is a reality to Chicago politics, too. I mean, and Obama epitomizes it.
Well, I think he does to some people. I mean, I think Chicago, like you said, is a very easy epithet. I think it does connote, you know, again, buying votes and all kinds of assorted stuff. Barack Obama did come of age in this city politically. I mean, he got elected, you know, to the state legislature many times in the city. So obviously it's going to, you know, I guess certainly toughen a politician up and probably teach him some things. But I do think that the politics that he practices and that his predecessors have practiced is independent of any specific jurisdiction.
Let me bring another caller on here, and we'll go next to Paul. Paul, join us. Welcome.
Hi, thank you, Michael. Good to speak with you. Thanks, Mark. Mark, I've heard you interviewed on several media outlets, Bill Moyers, et cetera. I'm starting to read your book. I'm about three-quarters of the way through Lawrence Lessig's book. And here's my simple proposition. We've heard the diagnosis of the problem now ad infinitum. Millions of words, millions of, you know, hours on TV, people talking about it. I think the time now is for past diagnosis, and it's time for cure. I'd like to encourage everybody to now start to focus on what we do to address the problems that we know are plaguing Washington and plaguing our democracy. And I know it's not the purview, perhaps, of your book, but I'd like to see perhaps some more words written about possible solutions. And I'll just proffer a simple one here. Taking a page out of the right-winger who made everybody sign a tax pledge. Help me here.
Grover Norquist,
sorry. How about a 5-point pledge that every politician has to sign on to? For example, a $250 limit on how much you can give to a candidate for every person or any entity, corporation or union. $250, period. Limits on lobbying, limits on coming out of the revolving door and then making money on the outside. 5 simple.
You mean moral pledges, or do you mean pledges that are signed in blood, that are legal and carry with them something punitive? Because I suppose, you know, we've been talking about campaign finance reform and things of that sort for a long time, and there always seem to be loopholes that you can, as Arnold Schwarzenegger used to say, drive a huge truck through.
Now, look, I mean, my book doesn't have the 10 bullet point chapter at the end in which I get up on my soapbox and declare how we can make this better. It's not my role. I mean, certainly, I mean, Paul pointed to a lot of the basic themes. I mean, campaign finance, revolving door. I mean, I think that the country is very ripe for a third party candidate if such a thing were realistic. I think term limits are something that, I mean, I don't advocate for it or not advocate for, but I think what you've seen now is with this permanent feudal class is an advertisement for possibly, a healthy approach, or maybe a shorter amount of time people spending in town. But look, I mean, I hope prescriptions come. I mean, I think that there is an incredible hunger for change. I wish I had a more satisfying end to this paragraph in which I could just tell everyone how it's all done, but I'm just not that smart. Or, I mean, I guess it's just not my role.
And Mark Leibovich with us in studio. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco this evening. He is chief national correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and author of This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral Plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Max writes, having spent years involved in local politics in the area, I've seen so many of the tropes that your guest describes just on a smaller scale. He sounds as if he's fundamentally giving us an essay on the trappings and human failings surrounding power itself. How much of that situation does your guest feel is not about Washington but about humanity? I see themes here that go back to Greeks.
All true. I mean, I think, look, I mean, Washington is a city of people. I think Washington is a writ large version of what people see at the local level. I mean, in all ways. Look, I mean, it's a city of very, very fragile egos, very, very big egos. People love power. I think it attracts a certain sort. But no, I mean, it's a very, very writ large version of what the writer is talking about.
And you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Mark Leibovich. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go to Ron next. Ron, welcome.
Hi. The question that goes back to my working with Global Garden Projects and the Hamilton Air Force Base closure. How, as a citizen, how do we actually track, as with Barbara Boxer and her relationship with Goldman Sachs, how do we track these politicians before they leave and become employed by these organizations in that process in the more immediate, rather than what bills they're putting forward? How do we actually track that? What is the opening?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of financial disclosure as far as who they're taking money from, who they're taking meetings from. I mean, a lot of it's happening, I guess, in ways that you can't see. But, I mean, when Chris Dodd runs for president and he's chairman of the House or the Senate Banking Committee and he raises about half of his money from Wall Street, I mean, you can sort of see where that's all going to sort of lead. So, look, I mean, transparency is effective to a point. I think there's probably a need for more.
Let me thank you for the call. That's Ron, and we'll go to another caller, and that's John. John, hi.
Hi. This is a great show. I'm a great radio show. What I wonder why it hasn't happened 50 years ago or 30 years since Ronald Reagan became president. I mean, everything you say is true. We've known that for decades out here, but yet nothing is ever done about it except people talk about it. The people don't seem to respond. Most of them don't even believe it. They can't believe their government is corrupt, that their country is corrupt. Corporate wealth has corrupted everybody. It goes to every level of society, the press, and the people are sheep. They just don't seem to get it.
John,
I don't understand.
I think you're raising an important question here. I mean, why haven't things changed? And we get back to one of the main premises of Mark's book, which is that lobbying and the money flowing into Washington is about making certain that things don't change.
No, I think that is true. I mean, the status quo is very, very, very handsomely rewarded. And what I wanted to do with this book is lay out in I guess, gory detail and sordid detail or sort of glorious, glorious decadence or whatever, what this all looks like and what the price of the status quo looks like and how, again, I mean, I keep coming back to the word carnival, but this is what has sort of devolved in a city that, again, was supposedly built on something better.
Well, I've got a listener named David who says, we need campaign reform at all levels of government. It's what Common Cause was promoting, 20, 30 years ago? We need it now more than ever. We need to make it impossible to change from private sector work to government work without an 8-year hiatus between jobs.
Look, the Obama administration has tried. I mean, they were going to close the revolving door. And you've had an administration in which the top spokesman at the Treasury Department, Jake Seward, is now the top spokesman at Goldman Sachs. The top spokesman at the Pentagon is now the top spokesman at BP. The head of the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, Peter Orszag, went straight to Citigroup. So you have probably the three biggest corporate nemeses of the Obama administration now being, certainly helped at the highest levels by direct alumni of the Obama administration. So, again, I think that's a pretty seamless example of what we're talking about.
And on point here, I think Val joins us. Val, join us.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Michael. And Mark, your book, and I've been, I'm very, very grateful for people like you that are letting us know what's going on there. I noticed Barack Obama in 2008 in his acceptance speech in Chicago said that he was going to go after the lobbyists, and it disappeared at that point, and nobody even cites that fact or asks him to be accountable for that. That shows how hard it is to actually get after this particular problem. I wanted to ask you, Mark, where you imagine the lever for the change is going to come from. This is a lot like the Gilded Age to me. It's like they're getting away with murder right in front of our eyes, and we all know it. But it takes something more than electing a more honest person or a smarter person. It takes something else. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is, I think, you know, the term gilded is, I think, very important. I mean, I think the subhead is America's gilded capital. And I think, look, I talked to a ton of people in the Obama administration at very, very high levels. I would love to know what the president thinks of so many of his people going right to K Street or going right to these, you know, many of the entities that he ran against, whether it's cable news or just the money culture that, that he was so sickened by in 2008. They all basically throw their hands up. One of the surprises about this book is that very, very few people have actually gotten their backs up. I mean, I have talked to many people at the highest levels of the administration, and they've said, yeah, this is sort of what we did, and this is what we do now, and I'm going to cash in because I can, and people are willing to pay this to me, and that's sort of what I'm going to do. And we had a great run, and I'm proud of the president, and I'm proud of what we did. I don't know what the president himself thinks, but I do think that there's an awareness there, which is the first step.
Well, you're out there increasing the awareness, and I applaud you for that, and keep it up. One never knows where muckraking can lead. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
Mark Leibovich, he'll be at the Commonwealth Club this evening. The book, again, is This Town. Thank you for joining us this hour of Forum. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.